Welcome to Change Hackers, providing daily insight and inspiration for people changing their world. I'm your host, Tony Cook, and I invite you to join me today in conversation with someone on the front line of driving change and transformation. My guest today is Carolyn Melodo, Senior Manager for Corporate Responsibility and Human Rights at Hilton Worldwide. Starting with a Master's in International Relations from Johns Hopkins University, followed by an early internship with Professor John Ruggie, the United Nations Special Representative on Human Rights, Carolyn has rapidly built a career as one of the leading international corporate executives working on human rights anywhere in the world. I have the lifelong bragging rights that I gave Carolyn her first proper job whilst I was at Sodexo. We were lucky to have her. Not only was she way smarter than me, but also way younger, more energetic, and with so much more about her than I ever had in my early 20s. It was clear it wouldn't be long before she moved on to bigger and better things, which sure enough she did. I caught up with Carolyn online from her office in Washington, D.C. So, Caroline, welcome to Change Hackers.
Thank you very much.
Listeners won't know, but we used to work together. It's going back a few years now. I think it was probably just about your first proper job.
Indeed. Well, at least the first one I got paid for, which I was grateful for.
You're now in a really interesting role, taking care of human rights at a global level for Hilton Worldwide as a hotel chain. We'll get into some of that in terms of the frustrations and challenges and hopes and dreams for the role. Before we do, I just want to start with exploring how you got started on this path. What was your first memory of things like human rights and social injustices and so on being something that you really cared about?
That's actually a very interesting question that got me thinking, trying to find where we really might have all started. And I guess a lot of it is fed by the stories and history of my family. When I look back at my grandparents, on the one hand, my grandfather, who had been forced to work for the Nazis in Brittany, in France, and who escaped with his brothers and started a whole business from scratch there, just going from house to house, helping, you know, clear out different houses and transporting stuff, which got him started on his entrepreneurial journey to become actually a pretty large entrepreneur in transportation in France. And it all started from escaping the Nazis. And he has always had a very, very strong discourse around the necessity for freedom and agency for each individual to make their own choices. On the other side, my grandmother on my other side has always been a big inspiration for me, as she also told me about the war stories where they escaped with then three young children to the countryside, also in Brittany, in France, and having to learn to live with a German soldier being based in their house, also having to learn how to raise a family with not much and how to create a community around it. And ever since, she grew to raise six of her own children, another two cousins, and countless other children of other friends that needed taken care of. So I guess there was also that feeling of community and solidarity. And that really fed through both of my parents in the way that they are also both lawyers. And so having that strong sense of the law, but the law being a tool that we can use to achieve a social and societal objective. And I've very much been inspired in particular by my mother, who has been straddling the family life as well as being a professor, and always striving to develop new ways that the law indeed could do just that. The law could be used to develop further goals. And from a young age, we even had discussions around, you know, equity, fairness. And in her field of law, it was looking at enterprises, but also as we were discussing about how it applies to each person. And then at the personal level, very much around the philosophy about one's own independence that starts with the respect for yourself, which is the way that you can respect others. I also got to experience quite intimately the questions of fairness and agency, because I was also raised by two bigger brothers. And that means that you got to run fast, be loud, and think even faster. So in a way, from a very early age, I had to learn how to argue, how to bring my voice to the table and to also share what was fair or wasn't, and how to develop an argument to try and match a certain discussion when you are very young with, you know, 4 and 6 year older brothers. That actually is quite formative. So I had to develop that grit from a very early age. And I think that it also stayed on with me, which in a way provided me with that almost innate need, sometimes to a fault, to make a point and to advance an argument that I feel passionate about. And so I suppose that that also participated in those formative years.
I very much recognize that quality in you. I remember it well. Are you saying then that you were instinctively introvert and the sibling competitiveness, rivalry, whatever you want to call it, forced you into being more extrovert?
Introvert by nature. I think I'm pretty much extrovert, but I think it's the way that it comes across that has been shaped very much by interaction. And I guess, you know, anybody who has siblings, especially older siblings, will recognize that, I suppose. And having also siblings with strong personalities. And it's, you know, it's a blessing in many ways, because I was lucky to also be taken along to do the plays and the going out and everything with my older brothers at, you know, a significantly younger age than theirs. And I was still, you know, taken along to experience the same. So it's helped me grow also fast. And but it also necessitated kind of that faster thinking to be able to even be part of those groups of their friends and be able to interact, because they were quite older than me at an early age. So definitely very formative.
It's something that's, if not unique, is rare as an experience amongst change agents. So more commonly you find people looking back on their early adulthood, you know, and they're entering into the workplace, suffer from a lack of confidence to speak up and say what they believe, partly because they don't believe that people more senior and more experienced will value what you have to say.
No, it's true. It's in that sense, and again, perhaps sometimes to a fault, because on the flip side, I've been told pretty much all my life that I'm also probably too loud or, you know, too daring. But at the same time, I never, ever felt the scare from hierarchy. Respect and deference, sure. But scared,
well, that was one of the things we loved about working with you, was your fearlessness. Even though from time to time you got slapped down, so look, the time you run, pick your battles.
Exactly, yeah. And that's and I suppose that's where I've been very. I've been lucky to have colleagues along the way, for sure, including you and our colleague at the time, Thomas, who were much wiser than me and could provide me with some advice with the hindsight of experience about how to manage, I suppose, that grit or energy in a way that is constructive. And to this date, I very much benefit from that advice from different sources at work, outside work, and try to be more effective with this. It's not easy. As you know firsthand, I'm pretty argumentative, so I don't always take no for an answer, pretty much never, but I take explanations and advice as a gift, and I am very grateful for that, the patience, I suppose, that I get from dear colleagues around me and definitely mentors to help me carve a path that is constructive.
So there's a humility there and a self-awareness that we're all a work in progress, and an awareness of your weaknesses, things you need to improve on, and receptiveness to advice from others. Something about this kind of nature of the mentor-mentee relationship, it's often something that's very informal, and it's not always about line management or hierarchy. It's just people that you respect and admire, who you choose as the mentee. You know, you latch onto them, you emulate, you observe the way they do things. Are you conscious that people coming through behind you are starting to do the same thing with you?
I hadn't actually thought about this, but now on reflection is probably what I'm proudest of. I've had the privilege of hiring someone, building a team of three and managing them for over 2 years, close to 3 years. Yeah, 3 years until now. And yeah, it's very weird to see that other people might be sharing, you know, that they are really learning from you, or that looking up at the way you behave when I'm like, wow, I've just been told that I always need to calm down the way I behave, so surely I can't be a model. So that's it's a really weird experience, and in a way probably one of the most fulfilling, not necessarily being ready in a way to be at all a mentor or an example in the way that I'm still trying to learn so much on how to do things. It's kind of odd to see that one can be indeed a mentor to somebody else. And yet, it's a responsibility, it's a gift. I very much see it as a privilege, and it's been by far the most fulfilling experience. However much I loved and still love being mentored and growing as a person, this has nothing to compare with the privilege of getting to know someone who gives you trust, their trust, and where you are being allowed to be part of the journey. And it's the most fulfilling experience, absolutely.
I can relate to that 100%. So can we come back to human rights? Very few mm-hmm. people get the opportunity to pursue a passion as in as focused a way as you have. Okay, it's not been linear. You've had to find your way into it. But I think listeners would be really interested to hear about the kind of the trajectory you took. You know, how have you discovered where you can have agency around an issue that you care so strongly about?
Yes. So interestingly, when I was in undergrad, I dabbed in a couple of sectors that I thought were exactly what I wanted to do. So I started with some journalist experience, and then I said, no way, I don't want to be writing about what others people are doing, I want to be doing. So I left that. Then I moved on and had an internship in diplomacy, just a summer internship. And just looking at how the diplomats were behaving, I'm like, wow, no way, I am definitely not that diplomatic. There is no way I could ever defend a certain policy or, you know, line of positioning if I don't really believe in it. I could never fake it. So no, diplomacy is not for me. However, what I discovered through the diplomacy aspect, and in a certain way it's through journalism as well, is that those are tools in terms of the format that you can apply to another topic. And I've been very lucky, and it's been also a decision to find and pursue the topic that I chose using all the tools that you have in diplomacy. And every single day, I am an ambassador. Not just an ambassador as in an advocate, literally, I try to put things forward in a way that perhaps an ambassador would try to do with a peer, to put, you know, an agenda, a topic on the other person's agenda that was not already theirs. So I suppose it's there was that willingness to be proactive parts of how society shakes and moves, but also a realization that it had to be something I was passionate about. I was very lucky to get the opportunity to do an internship during my master's with the, at the time, Special Representative for Business and Human Rights at the UN.
John Ruggie.
And it was during his first mandate, so when he actually developed the framework of Protect, Respect, Remedy for Business and Human Rights, even before the UN Guiding Principles. And, you know, combination of total chance. Well, chance and chance, really, being the right person at the right time, out of sheer luck, I got to deep dive into the role of business in, again, what can shake and move society for the better. Because that's why I was playing with journalism and diplomacy, mm-hmm. right? And so that's where I completely fell in love with the role that business can play in changing society for the better. I had always been interested in human rights throughout all of my undergrad and grad school. always focusing on international law and human rights law. And so I saw finally a way that we could bring it for real into the practical world. And so fast forward that internship and the first internship I got to do actually in within our, well, the company where we work together, Tony, I started as an internship there as well, looking at supply chain code of conduct, which really was a right bridge between my human rights kind of purely academic knowledge and then setting a foot in the private sector. And ever since, those roles don't exist, right? Especially 8-9 years ago, there was no role for business and human rights. It just doesn't exist. Even today, it's very, very rare, let alone for fresh grad students, right? Right out of master's. So I tried to bring the agenda forward, leveraging what I learned with the Ruggie team, but it was not the right time. And also, again, being one of the, you know, being a very junior person, it's pretty hard to come forward and, you know, try to provide a strategic advice to a multinational. It's not really the right place necessarily, right? It has to be engineered in a way that it's the right person carrying the message to the right receiver in a context where there is some sort of push and or pull for the institution, in that case, the company. And that didn't exist at the time in that very first role, that very first job that I had when we used to work together. But I kept at it. And in my next role, when I've been provided great trust in picking up a pretty massive region, starting corporate responsibility for a huge region for a multinational, that was my job, the regional role. And it took me about a whole 4 months to put forward a proposal to build human rights. And I guess where the biggest difference was there is... again, being at a different position, all of a sudden I was the head of, if you wish, albeit very junior, but head of a region, having a leader who saw for the team, who saw the opportunity, and who was ready to support and back the agenda at the highest level, which means to the right recipient of the message, who could have the power to say, yes, go forward. And that was transformational.
But then it's important to also combine that with delivering on bite-sized chunks at your level in the organization. In terms of things you can point to and say, that's my contribution, that's my impact. I mean, I remember having those conversations with you quite frequently. The focus of what you were trying to influence in your first role was so strategic, so, you know, kind of board level. Yep. You know, there was a danger of never leaving anything on the CV, if you like, in terms of, you know, progressing to the next role, because you weren't bringing it back to your reality.
Which is very interesting, actually, and maybe I'm taking it to a slight segue, but I think it's an important discussion, especially as we're talking about change agents. Very often, the way that career goes is that you start with tactical stuff, that you need to implement in detail. And then over time and with trust, you will be entrusted to do more managerial and strategic jobs. Now, what I find potentially not very efficient and certainly extremely frustrating, depending on the types of personalities, is that being tactical and detail-oriented is one type of personality. And being more strategic is a completely different set of skills. And I'm not sure that because you're young, you are better at details, you know, as being younger and earlier in your career, versus not good at strategic. Not having the experience is definitely one thing that needs to be considered and complemented by other in the team. But the strategic thinking is an ability that I don't think is necessarily only gained through career. And conversely, we see all too often fantastic experts, technicians, right, in their fields who excel at implementing whatever their field of expertise is. And then we promote them to a managerial level and entrust them with building a whole new strategy. And oftentimes we see extremely successful individuals and or teams who can perhaps be impeded by those changes, where the person who might get put at the helm might not be as strategic. And so I guess it's here is just, you know, big step back in things that we, I suppose, we have all seen in different organizations, and it's not only private sector for that matter. And so probably reflecting back to what I was trying to do is laying on something that is more natural for me, which is thinking strategically. I'm terrible at details. You know that firsthand. Detail-oriented work is not working for me. But I like strategy. And with the right guidance, I hope I can provide and contribute
value. I guess it's value. Reflective of the prevailing organizational culture. You know, what a common feature of most organizations' culture is this sort of reserving of strategic thinking and responsibility to more senior roles. And whereas, I mean, you know, research shows that younger, newer, whether they're younger or not, but newer hires, you know, people in their first 3 to 5 years of joining an organization are at their most innovative and at their highest level of risk appetite during those first few years. And then it declines quite sharply after that. And so we entrust strategic thinking often to the wrong people. So I think it's an interesting observation you've made around, you know, it's a mindset, you know, it's a quality that people have. I mean, yes, you can train it, you can develop it, but there is a big difference personality-wise between people who have a preference for detail and follow-through as opposed to people who are big-picture thinkers. And we don't capitalise on that enough within large organisations.
Exactly.
And give enough respect and voice to an agency to people who are wired that way, albeit younger and more junior. How do you seek to overcome that within what influence you've got?
So I think what is transformational is to have almost the vetting, the backing of those older, more senior and more seasoned colleagues who have been in the business for longer and who can provide two things. One, to me, the strategic advice, right, on how to play the game. What is the format? Because it's more than the content. It's really what is the format for delivery, the right timing, to whom? And so that's something that makes a strategy break or fail. Because otherwise, you can drive the most beautiful strategies all day. They're not gonna go anywhere. So that's the first thing that again I'm really grateful for, because you can't make it up. You can't make up experience. And the second thing that those also mentors can provide is the vetting externally to the key decision makers to confirm that, yes, whatever I might be putting forward might be worth listening to. And so that helps frame the potential for those key, very senior decision makers to pay attention to the suggestions made.
There's something there about more senior people providing a degree of air cover for you, as well as sponsoring your ideas in and being a carrier of the message to people who wouldn't listen to you, perhaps by nature of the sort of gap between your seniority. I'm curious, though, as to the balance between that in terms of making explicit your ideas and sharing them versus the sometimes necessity to remain covert about something. To at least try it out, test it, see if it works at a very manageable, low-risk scale to give
Absolutely.
You some evidence that something could work, because it might be perceived as risky higher up in the organization.
Yep, absolutely. Now you're spot on, and that's very much my experience. And here it's, you know, in human rights, but also across in CR in general. And so what I found really useful is to test out the ideas with actual peers. So actually people at my level. So a lot of people who would be, who are doing the job on the ground, where we are trying to perhaps look at, you know, in strengthening the human rights due diligence in whatever aspect of the company. And so trying out having a proof of concept, basically. And this is absolutely critical to also have the credibility to then escalate it and share a certain approach. What I found very difficult, and that's part of some of, you know, the challenges/failures where that you learn from, right, is perhaps having gone a little bit to grassroots. Because when you go very, very grassroots and some sort of projects start taking shape, if you haven't had the obvious and known green light from the top, it can go in all possible directions and potentially and indeed kill projects, or at least pause them for a very, very long time. Because then it becomes political and perhaps sensitive to touch. And so your allies who are at the same level as you will not want to get any further involved unless or until there is, you know, the green light coming from the very top, and then we can pursue. So I found that it's a fine balance. I really believe that the grassroots kind of testing is worth doing, notably because I'm also not an expert in, you know, in whether it be procurement or you know, other HR issues or whatever it may be, where there is a human rights aspect. I can't pretend to know about that. I need to spend a lot of time with the real professionals to understand how they work. And that's where you get the proof of concept. So we can't be good, especially in support functions like human rights or CR, corporate responsibility to some extent. We can't be good advisors if we don't understand how things work in a business properly. So that's critical. Now, testing it out, I think it's, yes, in a careful way, in a thoughtful way. And I suppose that's where having the even more of that strategic advice of some of your mentors or, you know, strategic partners who are more senior can provide some advice as to the level of risk that would be accepted within that specific organization. And given the specific individuals involved to find the right balance. It's not easy. And
so you don't rely on wholly on your own instinct of where the balance is in terms of how public you go versus how much you prototype stuff covertly level. You rely on putting feelers out, getting a sense of it from experienced, wise colleagues who can act as critical friends.
Well, perhaps I started more from my guts and I learned the hard way that it was not sufficient. So I'm not doing that enough. And I'm sure that will not surprise you. But yeah, no, I started doing it myself and being also trusted to do so. And that's also, you know, you find the boundaries when you push for it. You can't discover where the boundary is until you cross it. And when you cross it, well, yeah, you get, you know, slapped on the wrist. Hopefully it's nothing worse than this. But that's also how you can test boundaries. So in many ways, I have been testing boundaries. Having found them, now, you know, it's also learning, looking backwards, learning that, okay, for sure, it's, you know, I need that advice.
So how, I recognize that. And it's, I think that that kind of certain amount of acting and seeking forgiveness is a necessary ingredient to being a change agent, because partly because, as you say, it helps you discover where the boundaries are in a particular organizational culture, you know, with respect to risk appetite and so on. And obviously you get better at that over time. But it makes me think of kind of the necessity of resistance as well. You know, very rarely is acting and seeking forgiveness a career limiting thing. And that's not, it seems to me, particularly well understood. You know, I think if you do it in a sensible way and you're showing hunger and ambition and, but sensitivity at the same time, you know, it can be just put down to experience by more senior, wiser, experienced colleagues. And then over time, you just get better and better at it. But the nature of being a change agent still requires a certain amount of resistance pushing back against you.
It does, absolutely. Well, yeah, that's what you're doing in changing, right? You're trying to change the way people think, the way people behave, the way people understand what the truth is or what reality is. It's funny. I think that's especially on the human rights front, because it's a new thing for companies and organizations in general. It just doesn't belong to the vocabulary, to the reality of what a business environment looks like. So, and that's also what I love. That's fundamentally what I love most, is bringing that awareness and then getting their ideas when the colleagues become generators of ideas for change themselves. That's absolutely wonderful.
So where do you get stuck on that at the moment? What keeps you awake at night thinking, how do I crack this nut?
There are many things that keep me up at night, given, I suppose, the world we live in and the way that the economic system that we've built for ourselves unfortunately encourages exploitation of individuals and in an increasing way. It's cheap. It's like low risk, high reward to exploit an individual, much more than drugs or weapons, for that matter. So that keeps me up at night because in the way that we have just wired our whole economic system makes so that it's nobody's responsibility to look into why there is an exploitation here or there. And working in a business environment, we have very set, defined financial, legal prerogatives and or liabilities that make so that you should or should not look into ABC. And so what keeps me up at night, so apart from actual certain human rights violations that link to all businesses, really, in terms of the process, it's how difficult it is to try and effect change that is linked to the system in which we operate, a system that has built.
So it's extrinsic to the organization.
We live because of the economic system we have built, and it's a choice, which is why I want to keep optimistic, because we built this as a human society. This is not a science. This is a human construct. And there are lots of smarter ways to go about it. Not easy and not simple, but it's feasible. Anyway, going back to more of a micro level, looking at a specific organization, in particular in the private sector, the organization is not operating in a vacuum. And so kind of blurring the lines that have been built over decades of regulatory, legal, financial responsibilities, those lines are very well entrenched. And it's been working great because the companies are doing great. They don't need human rights to make profits, which is, you know, what ultimately they are trying to do. So that's what I find quite difficult, is to find a way to build, in a way, arguments to change certain ways of behaving, of thinking, and to, you know, just say, yes, we actually need to look at this, when everything has been built purposefully to not have to look at it. And that is really... that would be for any private sector organization in many ways, I suppose, also for other, perhaps from a government perspective as well, and NGOs, you know, going into more uncharted territories. But that's also what I find exciting, because we get to create. That's where we get to be creative. And that's where I go back to that belief that the law is a tool. And the laws that we have created for responsibilities of any actors, be it from governments, private companies, and other contractual law, it's a tool. And we have to find ways to use it smartly so that it actually helps really improve the world for the better. Otherwise, I really don't know what we're doing on this planet if it's not to make it better.
It's very telling that your departure point for your response to that question started with the very macro. It's just indicative of the degree of connectedness to the issue that you personally have. That you're upset, you're frustrated by injustices at a global, at a yep. population level, rather than at the very micro. Your response in terms of the micro, though, at an organisational level, at a cultural level, is. I just wonder whether. You know, this challenge around how you frame the argument, you know, it seems to be a perennial yep. theme that comes through, whatever your context, in terms of how you do the storytelling, build the narrative around the argument in language that makes sense to the audience, and how you have to nuance that for different audiences. With respect to human rights, I mean, where's it stuck in terms of how it's framed at the moment? You know, not in your company, but in business generally. I mean, is it still in the risk and compliance space, or is it has it moved beyond that, or starting to move beyond that, to, you know, this is who we are and part of our purpose?
So it's a bit of all of this. And to start with risk and compliance, I actually find it very useful, because tactically, that's how you change things within a company. Because if it is a compliance issue, things are going to move, and they're going to move fast. If it is a risk management issue, then the issue can be embedded across the whole enterprise risk management system and the way that the company responds to them. So I actually find this approach very, very useful. I'm pretty agnostic as to the value of an argument over another. And I don't really mind if somebody only looks at it as a tick the box exercise. Fine, as long as they do what you want them to do. I don't care. For others, it's going to be the moral arguments. Oh, this is just the right thing to do, and that's fine. I tend to not try to rely on it too much for two reasons. One, mostly, it's not sustainable, because you are dependent on a single person's morale and values. And you can't affect institutional change based on a single person's values, you know, and barring, you know, the chief executive who, you know, for whatever organization is going to be really passionate and drive something forwards, truth be told, given the myriad of issues that can be at stake, you know, you better not bank your whole career on the chief exec being your best champion. So you're going to be relying on other people in, you know, higher or lower ranked who will believe in the moral argument. And that's not sustainable, because those people will leave at some point. And so, you know, as much as I like the purpose approach for a company, and I think that this makes sense, I do find that it is highly dependent on the culture evolving, which for newly chartered territories like human rights, because it's not easy, huh? It's really not easy. I'm not sure that this is necessarily the first step. I do hope that it becomes that way over decades, but it's gonna take decades. I think, you know, it's a little bit like, look at the Me Too movement, right? Like, if you only rely on a person's values to say, oh, we should treat everybody the same, but then the whole society is also treating women differently, it's not going to change within the companies. And yet, you know, that's just now that we're seeing that movement taking hold. And it's not the first time that that we try, in a way. So I suppose, yes, it would be great the day where the whole world's coalesces around that belief that respecting each other is the way to go. But I won't bank on it to be the way to change practices now, because we can't wait for 10 years. It needs to happen now.
But it does require then a very nuanced approach to how you communicate around the issues and what needs to be done.
Yes.
In turn relies upon your understanding of where the audience is coming from, or that particular audience. And there will be many. Within the organization. How do you develop that kind of insight?
Oh, and that's fascinating, and I love that. It's like playing chess, and that goes back to that diplomacy approach, right? Because you want to understand the team you're talking to, and that's pretty easy, right? That you know what the team is doing, what are the team's objectives, whether they are in sales, in development, in procurement, in whatever it may be. It's pretty easy to know what their objectives are. And so how can you frame your argument in a way that it's going to help them achieve their objectives? So, I mean, it's perhaps it's simple, but not easy, I would say. It's simple to find the information. It still requires a lot of practice, I find, and discussions with, again, kind of those people at your level. Don't go too high. Don't go too low. Go at people at your level and or a couple of steps higher to provide accurate information about what the team is thinking in general, what the role of the team is, and also the very tactical, here is the strategy we're working on right now. Mm-hmm. Every single team is undergoing restructuring all the time. So it's important to be also attuned to what's happening so that your arguments can be framed as being part of the movement, as opposed to being really an extra, you know, kind of a completely incongruent topic. I just have a French phrase in my head. In French, we say like being a hair on the soup. So really something that is unwelcome. So you don't want to be that. No. Don't be the hair on the soup.
I can see that's going to be the title for this episode.
So that's also the contextual understanding of the team. And then you want to narrow it down even further to the actual individual who is making the decisions. And that's where you want to leverage their passion points, their history in the company, their membership of whatever board of whatever NGO, their passion point for XYZ. And here you totally leverage that to your advantage. And so you shape and, you know, in a way almost bastardize your arguments to make sure that it's going to be sweetened up. It's pure sales speech, right? Mm-hmm. You want to speak the language that the brains of your audience can understand and will welcome. So use the same words, the same references, whether it's cultural, social, it depends, right? Where even religious, whatever it may be in terms of the context of the organization, the country you operate in, where the person is coming from. And totally leverage that to your advantage. And so that's pure strategy. It may be a bit Machiavellian, but you know, if at the end of the day it helps change behaviors to help respect human rights, fine by me.
Kind of the ends justifies the means.
Yeah, I mean, you know, when you coerce by leveraging their humanistic values, that's okay. No corruption, though. No corruption.
Caroline, thank you so much. I wish we had more time. So thank you so much for joining us on Change Hackers.
Thank you very much, Tony.
I'm your host, Tony Cook, and I'm on a mission to provide inspiration and insight for people changing their world. So check out changehackers.org to read show notes, guest blogs, and subscribe to access bonus content. Remember, this show's for you and change hackers like you. So drop me a line, tell me what you love, what you hate, or ideas you have for improving the show. And let me know if you know someone who'd make a great guest on this show. Maybe a friend, someone you work with, maybe even you. Just use the contact form at changehackers.org. I'd love to hear from you. Till next time, Change Hackers.